This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. It's been 15 years since Americans watched in horror as Chinese troops crushed student protests in Beijing's Tiananmen Square, killing hundreds. My guest, journalist Ian Johnson, writes that Chinese authoritarian one-party state is again beset with protests, the product of economic reforms that have given Chinese families more income, more education, and new aspirations. As Beijing's correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, Ian Johnson won a Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for his reporting on the government's repression of the Falun Gong spiritual movement. He is now the journal's Berlin bureau chief. Johnson's new book, Wild Grass, tells three stories of Chinese citizens who've taken on the government over excessive taxation, corruption, and denial of religious freedom. We began with a reading.
China's rulers have developed a bad case of the nerves. Unemployment is high, corruption permeates daily life, and relations with the outside world result in recurring crises. Often these tensions erupt in small protests, sometimes against the government, oftentimes against outsiders. They usually end after a few days, often crushed, sometimes petering out when a few ringleaders are arrested and the protesters' demands partly met. But they are never resolved, surfacing like a corpse that won't stay under. When the anniversaries of these protests come around a year later, commemorations are held and petitions delivered. Some of these grudge dates are intensely local. A family's memory of its house torn down to make way for a corrupt real estate project, or a village that commemorates a local leader arrested for standing up to abuse. Other commemorations are shared by millions, the killing of students or the banning of a popular religion. The government, ever watchful for challenges to its rule, tries to keep track of all of them. Protests, arrests, detentions, each year the victims try to commemorate these disasters, and each year the government tightens up around these dates. Slowly, the country's mental calendar has become a series of overlapping scabs and sores.
Ian Johnson, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks.
The three cases that you detail in your book, Wild Grass, all involve, they're different kinds of content. We have peasants who are angry about unfair taxation. In one story and another, we have people who are protesting the way development's happening in Beijing, where they're being thrown out of their homes and not getting compensation. And then you have the repression of the kind of religious and spiritual group, the Falun Gong. But in each of these cases, we have citizens who go to court to seek redress of their grievances. I mean, they're allowed to file petitions and seek some due process. And I think a lot of Americans who know relatively little about China would be surprised to hear that there are courts they can go to. What's the state of due process there for citizens?
Well, that's one of the contradictory and really fascinating developments in China, that there is a legal system that's being developed. China has passed scores and scores of laws, marriage law, contract law, all kinds of laws, and it set up a sort of rough and ready legal system. And in some cases, people can challenge the government. I mean, you don't sue the government for fundamental human rights or constitutional rights, but you can challenge the government on some basic problems that maybe the government has made a bad decision in assessing your taxes or hasn't fairly compensated you for tearing down your house, something like that. In those cases, you can challenge the government in court.
Well, one of the successful challenges occurred in the mid-90s. There were these peasants in, and I may get the name wrong, Peijuan, do I have the name right?
Yeah, that's about right.
They felt that they were being overtaxed by corrupt local officials. They hired a lawyer, drafted a petition, and won.
Yeah, it was a really interesting case. There had been a drought that had wiped out the crops in this region of China, this western remote hilly region. And the local officials had simply demanded the normal taxes. The locals said, we don't have any money to pay the taxes, and the officials had simply gone into their homes and taken away their private belongings, things like televisions or whatever they owned, and said, okay, we're taking this in lieu of taxes. And the peasants got angry, pooled some money, and hired a lawyer, and were able to sue the government and win. However, when another group of peasants tried to do the same thing the next valley over, they lost.
Now, was the case that they had as strong as the successful complaint by the peasants in Pejuan?
Yeah, it was basically an identical case. What had happened was the party had a campaign going at that time to tell local officials that they shouldn't abuse their power with the peasants and they shouldn't overtax the peasants. And so the first case won. And then all of a sudden, all these other groups of peasants said, well, we want to sue too. We were also overtaxed. And the government went, holy smokes, we have potentially millions of peasants suing us. So they just cut it off and said, okay, one group can win. We can use that for a little propaganda campaign, but we're not fundamentally going to allow a precedent to be set here. And so they just stopped.
When the peasants formed a group to press their case for relief from these burdensome taxes, it's interesting. They gave it a name. They called it the County Farmers Anti-Corruption and Reducing Tax Burden Volunteer Liaison Small Group. That's a quaint-sounding name, but I gather that that set of words was intended to convey particular messages. What did the name mean?
Well, the name was, first of all, a couple of slogans. They were reducing the peasants' burden, reducing the tax rate, which was an official government policy. And also, by using the word small group, it makes it seem like sort of an unofficial, not some sort of an organization, because all organizations have to be registered with the party. So they called it a small group to make it seem like some sort of informal meeting of people and make it seem less threatening to the government.
Now, when Mr. Ma, the attorney for the peasants, made his way to Beijing, he wasn't just greeted with argument, right?
No, he was beaten and sent to prison and sent back to this region where he came from, where he was then put on trial.
When you interviewed his wife, she had a knapsack with a towel, right, and some documents.
Yeah, she had his bag, his sort of briefcase, and it was filled with, it had the article in the Legal Daily, which he carried around very proudly to show that he wasn't doing anything wrong, and it had a couple of books on rule of law in China, on the legal system, but it also had this bloody towel that he'd used to staunch the bleeding in his mouth.
When the criminal trial for Mr. Hua occurred, there were some pretty outrageous abuses of due process. I mean, witnesses were intimidated. There was denial of access to records. I mean, it really looked like a sham. And I found myself wondering, why would the government hold a trial at all? I mean, isn't it more damaging to their credibility to kind of offer a forum that appears to grant some kind of fairness, but then make it a sham? Why not simply rule by fiat? Why not simply throw people in jail without trials?
Yeah, that's one of the paradoxical developments in China. The government is trying to set up this legal system, and so they feel they have to use it. So they had a trial for him, and as you say, it was largely a sham, but it gave Mr. Ma a chance to write down a fairly impassioned defense, one that was later photocopied and passed around among lawyers in that part of the country. And I guess the government, the basic problem is the government doesn't, it uses the legal system to rule the country. There's sort of the concept of rule of law, and that's where the law is supreme. Everybody has to follow the law. Here, the government is following rule by law, where it uses the legal system to rule the country. And I think here you see this is quite a distinction, quite an important distinction.
Tens of thousands of peasants signed this petition, and I'm sure dozens were actively involved, maybe hundreds, maybe thousands, and they saw their economic grievances ignored and their leaders jailed. What do you think the effect, long-term effect, was on them and their sort of political consciousness?
Well, when I talked to peasants there, they felt, to use the cliche, they felt empowered. They felt that they had really stood up to the government. And even if they lost the case, they still felt, and I think it's probably true, that local officials wouldn't treat them again in such a cavalier fashion, that they would think twice before breaking down their doors and taking away their possessions, because they had created such a ruckus. Okay, they lost, but you can argue that change happens often, but the people at the cutting edge of change aren't always successful, but in the long run, they do push the envelope of change.
My guest is journalist Ian Johnson. His book is Wild Grass, Three Stories of Change in Modern China. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Ian Johnson. He won a Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for his reporting on China. His new book, Wild Grass, tells three stories of citizen activism in modern China. Well, Ian Johnson, a very compelling story in your book is involves the Chinese repression of the spiritual group Falun Gong. Remind us of what this group is and why they appeared to be a threat to the Chinese government.
Well, Falun Gong sprung up in the early 1990s, a period when China was, when Chinese people were looking for some sort of meaning with the collapse of communism, left a spiritual void. It's a quasi-religious system. Some people may debate whether it's a religion or not. I would see it as a kind of religious system focused around one man and his book that tells people how to live a good life, and also exercises that help improve one's health. And throughout the 1990s, it just grew and grew, and you couldn't go to a park in Beijing or any other city in the early morning without seeing Falun Gong people practicing. But then they decided to protest in front of the government offices in early 1999 because they felt that there'd been a slight against them in one of the local newspapers, and they wanted the government to quit harassing them. So they protested, and the government banned them.
Your story begins with a woman from the city of Weifang, sort of a mid-sized Chinese city, who attempted the simple act of traveling to Beijing to engage in one of these protests, a small one. Tell us just, if you can, that scene where she goes to the capital, a strange place for her, and how does she encounter authority? She's going to go to a park and look for some other followers.
Yeah, people, as I said, had been practicing Falun Gong in parks, and she thought, well, maybe if I go to a park early in the morning, I can find some other practitioners and ask them where we can go and protest. She was quite a naive person, quite a simple person. She'd been in a factory her whole life. She had had very little formal education and was, basically barely literate. So she goes to this park and she's looking around to see, do I see any people practicing Falun Gong? And she's completely out of place here. She's dressed in simple sort of peasant outfit. And these police officers come up to her and ask her, are you an adherent of Falun Gong? And one of the things that Falun Gong teaches is that you're not supposed to lie. And she said, yes, I am.
And that was enough. She was in jail.
That was it. She was detained, yeah.
She ends up eventually, after returning to Beijing a couple of times and is persistent, she ends up in more serious trouble and in this local re-education center. And you learn some rather chilling details about circumstances there. Give us some of that.
Right. She was held in one of these centers, re-education. They were called transformation centers, where they tried to transform you to get you to change your mind, to renounce your belief. And she refused to. They asked her again and again. They held her there. They called her daughter and said, look, you need to come down and get your mother to change her mind. You need to pay a big fine. And the daughter was, at that point, frankly, a little ticked off at her mother, and she couldn't understand, what is up with Mom? Why won't my mother just recant? I mean, what's the big deal? Why does she insist on believing in this thing? And she didn't go down, and so her mother was held another night. They tried to get her again to recant. She wouldn't, and they began to beat her. And I was able to talk to witnesses in the cell and people who had smuggled letters out of prison, who describe how she was beaten and ultimately beaten to death.
Now, the repression of the Falun Gong was a national issue for the Chinese government. I mean, it got a lot of attention in the Western media. You wrote about it for the Wall Street Journal. Was the brutality and the killing of Mrs. Chen an aberration? Was it an isolated occurrence?
Well, not really. By conservative estimates, thousands of people were detained for their belief in Falun Gong, and dozens of people were killed. Falun Gong claims that hundreds of people were killed. That's hard to document, but human rights organizations and conservative estimates would show that certainly dozens of people died in police custody.
Now, why was the repression of Falun Gong so brutal in this city of Weifang, where this woman you profiled? Because it seemed that there was a disproportionate number of deaths there. Why was that?
Well, the government used a system that it used actually for economic reforms. It sort of it holds the lower level person responsible for fulfilling goals. And it's like that with, say, if you want to reform the economy, you say, well, you have to privatize so many companies. The lower level official actually signs a contract with you and says, okay, I promise to fulfill XYZ goals. And they do it. With Falun Gong, the government called all the provincial leaders to Beijing and said, you have to stop people from coming to Beijing. We don't care what you do. No measure is excessive, to quote the order that they gave, but you just stop people from coming to Beijing and protesting. And so the provincial officials then went down to the county, went down to the city, and on, and just sort of said, you have to stop people from coming from your county, from your city, from your village. And so the local officials just had a very strong interest in preventing anybody from doing anything like that. Now, in this particular city, it's not too far from Beijing, so it was possible for people to take a bus. Some people even rode their bicycles to Beijing, and some people even walked. And so they had a large number of people who were going to Beijing, and then they just implemented very harsh tactics against them. Basically, they just beat the faith out of people. If they didn't repent, if they didn't give up Falun Gong, they were beaten. And several people died.
You actually spoke to some local officials who thought that the repression was a terrible mistake, right?
Yeah, many local officials felt really bad about what had been happening. They knew a lot of the people who were involved, and they thought that this is not the smartest way to handle things, that these people were at worst sort of maybe religiously obsessed or whatever, but they weren't criminals. They didn't need to be thrown in jail and beaten.
And they thought it detracted from other valuable tasks that they needed to be performing, right?
China has so many things that it needs to do. I mean, it still has so many people living in poverty. It's trying to modernize its economy, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of worthwhile things that the government could be doing with its time rather than cracking down on a religious group.
The internet's had an enormous democratizing influence, some would argue, throughout the world. I'm wondering, do Chinese have the same access to the kind of range of opinions and material on the internet, and what's the effect?
Well, I think the first thing one has to remember is that China is still largely a rural country and still very much a poor country, and the internet use is not that wide, not as wide as in some countries like in the West. But in the cities, it has had an impact, but the material is controlled. Sites are blocked. Anything with sensitive material on human rights or Taiwan or Tibet or any issues like that, they're all blocked. And chat rooms and things like that are often monitored so that there's often a 15 or 30 second delay in a chat room. And if there's anything really bad or something that somebody's written, the government can just snip that out.
When you communicated with the Falun Gong people, you ended up having to send encrypted email, right?
Yeah, you can do that. You can download encryption software off the internet, freeware, and that's an effective way. But you still have to be careful because if you can still tell where the email was sent from, which computer. So it's still, if the government wants to keep a lid on something, they can still do it despite the internet.
Well, Ian Johnson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks a lot.
Ian Johnson is the author of Wild Grass, Three Stories of Change in Modern China.